The South Dakota Stories, Volume 5. South Dakota seemed like the perfect place to unplug. But I ended up connecting to the world around me. A world where each sunset was painted, where I felt adventures pulse with every step, and where cold water trickling, pine swaying, and grunting bison became my favorite soundtracks. I just wish I didn't have to leave. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, sitting here with Mick Foley here, 316 Gimmick Street. That's why I called a studio here, Mick. When you put it in your address on your little iPhone, 316 Gimmick Street, Mick shows right up. People all over the world keep telling me, Steve, I keep putting 316 Gimmick Street in my iPhone. It says address does not exist. You know it does because you're right here in front of me. Welcome to the crib. It's good to see your ass.
It's good to be here, man. I feel honored under a lot of pressure, though.
We ain't under no pressure because I was thinking, how do you start off conversation with my old travel partner and a good friend and a guy who's been down the road as many miles as you and I have? And then you drove up. I said, hey, park in front of the driveway because parking's tight. And as soon as you drove up, I said, that's where we're starting. You rent a car.
Let's do it, man.
Everybody knows you're one of the cheapest cats in the history of the business. And I say that with all due
respect.
With reverence,
yeah. I appreciate that.
You know,
yeah.
I'm number two right behind you. So you come cruising up in a brand new 2014 white Dodge Challenger. I said, damn, I thought you were going to stop putting some 24s on that. Come pimping ain't easy. So what's the deal with the damn hellacious car? I'm glad to see you treating yourself with a little style.
There was a defining moment in my life, and I don't swear much, right?
We'll do whatever you want.
I'm going to drop one for you.
You got it. This,
and very seldom did I talk in first person either, right?
Yeah.
But I remember my third day in the company, you know, WWE. I didn't have much of a relationship with Vince for a year or so, you know, like, hello, Mr. McMahon, how are you doing?
You called him Mr. McMahon?
In the beginning, yeah. Gotcha. And then I went so many years calling him Vince that I remember going back. It took me years to figure out. And this is going all the way back to when Vince had the explosion where Mr. McMahon had died. And I wasn't happy about it. And at that time, I had the stroke to say something. You know,
right.
That stroke is long gone. But I went up to him and I said, Vince, I said, you know, I got a call from a soldier who really was blown up, and he was worried about you. And I got a call from a little boy who really is dying, and he was worried about you. I said, this is an incredibly poor taste. And he goes, Mick, Vince McMahon didn't die. Mr. McMahon did. And I said, do you think our audience knows the difference? He goes, of course they do. And it was right then that I realized what he was talking about, like a year earlier when we're doing – it was a live backstage interview. Otherwise, he would have caught it. And I was calling – I referred to him as Vince. And he said, what did you call me? I said, Vince? Like, I never knew where he was going with it.
Yeah.
And where he was going with it was, he's Mr. McMahon.
Right.
And I had no idea they were two separate people.
Right.
So, yes, but going back to 96, I'm new in the company, and he comes up to talk to me. And he sees me putting something behind my back, you know, like a little kid. He finally asked me, what do you have behind your back? I said, nothing. What do you have behind your back? And he pries out of my hand a book that says, America's Sleep Cheaps. Cheap Sleeps. How to Stay Around the Country for Less Than $30 a Night. Because that was prime on my mind. You know, at that time, I didn't know how long my run was going to be. I had pretty good faith. A lot of experts, it wasn't going to be long at all,
yeah.
You know? So I was saving every dime I could, and it finally got to a point where I was in somewhere in West Virginia. I'm wrestling The Undertaker. I'm not on top, but I'm second from the top, you know? And it comes time for me to find a place to sleep, and I pay $25 cash. No credit cards accepted. You have to go around.
Do you smart marks out there, Kizash?
And I lay down on this bed. The bed just sags underneath my weight, $25 cash. And I just looked up at the ceiling and I said out loud, I said, what are you doing here? You're Cactus fucking Jack. And I talked in first person, called myself by my gimmick name, and cursed out loud. I went over to the guy and I told him that wasn't going to support my back. And I went in and I... and I got like a $50 room. I like went from the one star, you know, the bully to the two and a half, three star level. And I realized, you know, that, man, maybe those glory days were tripling up in the lodge, you know, they make for great stories, but I was going to have to invest in myself a little bit better. So although I would have loved to have shown up in a car that would have pleased you, first and foremost in my mind is comfort of the driver's seat. We were talking off air about the fact I went on a 15-date tour, 15 cities and 15 dates.
Suicide run.
11 states, 92 hours of driving. And I need that good front seat. And if you're...
You're Cactus fucking Jack.
I'm Cactus... I've already dropped my one F-bomb. I try to use one an hour when I do my show. And it's you take whatever's in the lot. If you're a national guy, you know, you get your pick once you've had that.
You're part of the club?
Yeah.
Like, I'm on the Hertz number one.
Yeah, club. Yeah. And you have your pick of seven or eight things. They had an SUV. They had a couple other things. And just the cars were too small. And I knew that Dodge had the prime...
I got in a while ago to move it. You parked the wrong way on my driveway, so I got in, spun that thing around. That's the first time I've ever driven one of them challenges. Pretty nice. Sweet ride.
Yeah, very nice.
You hauling ass? You got your thing buckled up?
Yeah.
Hey,
you know what
I saw? Yeah. Everybody, you got your iPhone. I saw your technology. And you and me go way back before cell phones were even around.
Yeah.
You got your road map over there. You don't just type in a destination on your iPhone. You got a physical road map.
Yeah.
The people listen to the Steve Austin show. Some of you are so young that y'all don't know that a paper map actually exists. And you look on the highways and byways and shows you how to get places. Mick Foley, Cactus fucking Jack, has a real road map on his passenger seat. You don't see them anymore.
You don't see them. And honestly, I don't usually travel with one. But there are times, you know, you have to verify. You know, you go type in your GPS, you get the thing, and then check it just to make sure it's okay.
Yeah.
Because I've been out there, and I'm sure you have too, where the GPS takes on a mind of its own, and you end up going a long way.
Me and my brother-in-law was in a car the other day. We was going to Chico, California from Sparks, Nevada. It says, hang a ride on Ellis Road. It's a dirt road.
Yeah.
We went a quarter mile down that thing and said, hey, do a U-turn. I ain't trusting this lady in the iPhone. We took the long way around, and sure enough, about 6, 7, 8 miles later, on the right-hand side of the road was Ellis Road. It was a shortcut, and
no
we didn't
kidding.
Take it. So it proved us. It kind of blew up on our face on that one. But
I'm all over the state. I'm all over the state of California, so I at least need to know where I'm going. I like to know, see where it is, and then I'll. Then
well,
I'll.
Let's talk about the state of California, because you're here right now. You're at my house right now, and you fix to go do a show in Pasadena. But as the show drops, you're going to be in Brea, California, the 14th. You're going to be in Ventura, California, on the 15th. And the 16th, a double shot, 31st of August, Denver, Colorado, 13th of September, Farmingdale, New York, 16th of September, Maple Ridge, B.C., 17th of September, Revelstoke, B.C., 18th of September, Vernon, B.C., 19th of September, Kamloops, B.C., 20th of September, Prince George, B.C., 21st, Grand Prairie, B.C., 23rd, Edmonton, Alberta, and then Lloydminster, Alberta on the 24th. And it goes on and on and on. All you got to do is go to realmickfoley.com to see where Jack is at or where, if you want to go check out his show. My question to you is, dude, what are you doing? Are you stark raving crazy? You're supposed to be kicking it now. You worked your ass off. You beat up your body. Steel chairs to the head. You should be kicking back, picking your spots. You're hitting it hot and heavy.
It's hard. You know, the dates are coming in. I've been working on this for 5 years. I went from where I couldn't get anybody to go to the show. I mean, it was frustrating. I'd do a book signing, and I'd have a good line. I'd do a minor league baseball game, great line. And when I asked people, hey, you going to go to my show, I could tell people were lying to me. They were creating excuses not to go to the show because it doesn't seem to make sense. It seems like a giant leap when actually it's like a little – sidestep, you know. I'd look at guys and they go, really, you're doing, I never should have called it comedy, should have gone with spoken word, should have coined a phrase like WWE did with
is it comedy or spoken word, just stories?
It's a wrestling centric storytelling show. That's hard to put on a marquee,
right?
That are largely humorous but don't have to be,
right?
And I can make a point, I can get a little, and I make sure if I'm going to get sensitive or sentimental that I got something really shallow lined up, you know, to dip my toe into. And I'll make points, you know. I try to cover some serious territory, but I also
like what kind of serious territory? I mean, is there any life lessons in your act? Because, I mean, God dang, many times we've been around together. A lot of our friends that have died, drugs, bullshit, stuff like that. I mean, you got any life lessons in your shows?
Man, you know, I mean, one of the
people not paying to see that. They want to just hear Mick Foley slap his gums.
I used to say I want to make people think as much as I want to make them laugh. And then when I got a real look at the economy and how tough some people had it, I became a big believer in the power of the smile. Like, you know what? They can get the heaviness somewhere else. I mean,
right.
It's, you know, like with my books, people picked up little lessons about life. People,
yeah.
I'm not going to force a lesson on people. If the one lesson I try to pass on is that, you know, you don't let the situation define for you what being a success is. You know,
right.
Like I always, you know, WrestleMania moments become part of like, it's part of the lexicon, you know? So I refer to things as my WrestleMania moment, you know? Like
right.
I had a thing where I was doing a little Santa Claus appearance because I have a weakness as you know for Santa, and I was doing it for a friend of mine who has a side project with Norah Jones, and I come in, I show up late, I almost left, I'm cursing out loud, the GPS tell me I'm on the Brooklyn Queens Expressway and I can see the BQE over me, I'm on the verge of leaving, and I looked in the mirror and I said, if you don't go back in there, and I got my beard bleached
right,
and my, you know, my skin's all burned underneath, you don't go back in there, the best jobs you can. You don't deserve to wear this. And so similar lessons to what you're doing in wrestling. And then when I walked in, it was like entering the land of Oz, you know. And I walk up there, I say my little piece. Norah Jones goes to sing Silent Night, and I'm looking at a microphone, and Norah Jones about 8 feet away from me. And I thought to myself, if you don't walk up there and start singing Silent Night with Norah Jones as Santa Claus, you'll regret it for the rest of your
Jack.
Life. Cactus freaking Jack. And that was like, I'm looking at it, about 400 people there, and it's like, this is a WrestleMania moment. Like,
right.
This is this feels as good as anything ever did inside that ring. And that's really the only lesson I have is that, you know, you can take a guy who used to perform in front of tens of thousands and put him in some case in front of tens of tens.
Yeah.
He's usually in the hundreds, you
yeah.
know? I mean, I need double digits to have a good time. You
yeah.
can't have a single digit crowd. But I'm enjoying it, and I go back. I have to go back to 2000 when I was the commissioner to think of a time when I had this much fun.
Right.
And from just a financial perspective, I mean, one of the problems you were like probably like me. It's a wonder that JR and I have stayed friends all these years because I was not shy about making that 203 phone call when I thought the paycheck was a little light.
You got to. Well, and this is a life lesson to any of the boys out there listening to this podcast. Hey, man, you got to rattle cage sometimes in regards to payoffs. And another quick segue, I always tell guys, these youngsters coming up, always ask the house, know your spot on the card, who you work with, and time is, you know, when it comes to Buck for promotion, you will have some
right.
concrete evidence and you will have learned the system. Continue your story.
I know we're going to go off on a lot of segues
yeah.
here, but I know people want to hear us talk wrestling, and you had Zach on a few weeks ago, and I felt like I had to write something about the Zack Ryder case, and I was going to call it the tragedy of Zack Ryder, and then I watched the evening news and saw real tragedies
right.
and ended up calling it the sad case or sad story of Zack Ryder. The saddest part about that whole situation is when I asked him what happened, he said, I don't know. I said, you never asked? And he shook his head and he said, no. And it's like, it's almost expected. Like,
right.
you need to, like, that's more than the big tests, like, above and beyond what you can do in the ring. You need to make that knock on that door and state your case. And in his situation, he had a rock solid case. He could
yeah.
point to merchandise.
Yeah.
He
got himself over on YouTube.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
great little show.
Yeah.
Long Island, IZ,
yeah. And people respond and say maybe he didn't have legs. He'd have to tweak the. Yeah, he would have to. But, you know, you need to
give something
make
a
the
shot.
Case. Yeah.
I mean, hell, the kid got himself over.
And so that is a lesson for everybody there is that, you know, when you first come in, of course, you're humble and you expect, you know, you're happy to be there. But the business doesn't do well with guys who are just happy to be there.
You got to paint a target on another guy up's back and go after that guy. I mean, you're out there to take everybody's spot. I mean, you don't really this is me looking back and reflecting.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as you were, I mean, God dang, we went down the road together. We yeah. were hungry as hell. Literally, we were starving. But we was always trying to make it one notch up on a card. I mean, you know, when you grew up as a fan of the business – and Jack lives on Long Island. Before we roll town, I said, you live in Long Island.
No, it's on
anyway,
an island.
Yeah. Dude, you just want to be a pro wrestler, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's always your dream to be the main event.
You know what, Steve, I'm in a little different categories. I've been told for so many years. Yeah, I didn't accept that was my end
Dude,
game.
Did they program you? They beat you down so
no,
much?
No.
You had so many naysayers. You overcame
I know
a lot.
It. But I never saw myself as being a champion. Like, I honestly, when you say, was my program a success? Like, you, in our case, we wrestled. You were going on to the you know, you were going on to the next big thing. When I had The Rock, it was because he was about to wrestle you. You know, like, I did. I knew my role, and I accepted it. I mean, to this day, when people say, like, does it bother you, you don't get enough credit? You know, that you're not up there with.
I think you do get plenty of credit. I do, but, too. But you had your naysayers while you were in the trenches.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of them.
Yeah.
Same. But the end game was making a contribution, and then having the best possible match I could, and then deciding whether or not the guy that I worked the program with was worth more to the company.
Right.
I honestly saw myself as a role player up until, you know, 90, you know, until I got to WWE and saw 90, you know, 96. All right, I can compete with the big boys. I remember taking that plane ride for my first tryout, and I was a little bit intimidated, and I had to sit back and think, wait a second, I've wrestled with about 2/3 of these guys.
Right.
You know, like, yeah, I'm going in to do business with The Undertaker, but deep down, he's the same guy I rode with six years ago. Like, it hasn't changed that much. I've had that level of pep talk to myself. It's an intimidating situation.
So then tell me these phone calls you would have with Jim Ross, because
I changed my tune.
Must be vociferously. Hell, I used a big word. He used lexicon. I come back with vociferously.
This is a wrestling podcast.
There's some dumb some bitches out there thinking, what the fuck are they talking about? I thought they were going to talk about steel chairs.
To this day, I can't say the word trepidatious without thinking of you. I was like, Pat, why are you being so trepidatious? Even used it in my Hall of Fame speech. You know, trepidatious is a good New York Times number one best-selling author word for hesitant.
Well, I got trepidatious from a Randy Macho Man Savage promo. He goes, trepidation is the word of the day, and went on to discuss his match with whoever it was at the time. Tell me about these phone calls with Jim Ross. How heated would they get? Because I talk to Jim all the time.
Yeah.
He says he talks to you pretty frequently.
Yeah.
He loves you to death. So obviously you guys are still great friends.
Yeah, it's a wonder.
How hot and heavy did you stand your case?
Yeah, fairly hot, fairly heavy, but not too frequently.
Right.
So they always made something. They always made a difference. They always meant something when I called.
Yeah, you're not pissing and moaning every paycheck. Yeah. You got to pick your spots.
But it was somewhere around 98, I think, when I realized that I was a player before the world got the message, you know, on that Monday night show where all the people turned the channel. And, you know, I did state my case, and, you know, Vince respected that. You know,
right.
JR would go to Vince, and there would usually be a little something extra in a couple cases, you know.
Right.
You know, a lot of extra money, and I think that was as big a battle as anything you'd be part of in the ring, was just fighting for what you thought you were worth.
You know, and speaking of what you're worth, when I came into the WWF as a ringmaster, I'd been down at WCW, and I'll talk about WCW money. When I left there, I was making about $275. My first year in the WWF, I made about $100,000 less than that. Then I started getting hot that next year.
Yeah.
And real hot. And it was coming on pretty fast. And this was back in the day when they would bring your W-2 or your 1099, whatever your tax return form is, at the building and hand it to you. And it was at a TV taping. It was a Monday Night Raw. I remember like it was yesterday. And many things I forgot from all the steel chairs.
Yeah.
I remember this. I got my 1099 or whatever you call it. And I looked at it and it said X amount of dollars. Man, I thought I'd really smoked everybody's ass at that point and come up the curve. And my pay didn't reflect that. And I was walking around in a pretty bad mood. And JR comes up to me and goes, what's going on? I said, hey, man, I just got my gimmick. And I said, I don't believe this is what I made. I should have made this. Well, let me talk to the old man. He went and talked to the old man. The old man made up the difference. And that was my big boost on the way to starting to make the coin that would come back in a day. But I voiced, you know, and stated my case and was pretty firm on it because I thought I'd had a killer year.
Yeah.
And so, but that was my first case of really having to start bucking for a promotion.
You know what?
But if you don't buck, Nick, to you youngsters out there, you got to buck because you got to learn.
Let me open up a can of figurative whoop ass here.
Go ahead.
Have you seen Drew McIntyre since he left WWE?
Wasn't he just on TV a while ago?
In Scotland.
Oh, he's in Scotland. No, I haven't.
Nice kid, right? Nice young man.
I met him one time.
seemed to be about where he should have been on the card. He reached out to me via social media, you know, what do you think I should do? And I said, watch WWE Countdown and watch what Paul Heyman says about Stone Cold Steve Austin when he left WCW, how Paul's secret was he took that anger that you had and the frustration and let you channel it into something productive. I said, watch that and learn from it. And a couple weeks later, I get this thing. He says, Drew says, would you be willing to watch something? I said, sure, I'll give it a view tomorrow. And when I say that, who knows, might be weeks before. I said, you know what? I owe it to this kid to watch this thing now. And it was like watching a different human being. Like if anyone would have said, do you think Drew Galloway, real name, has that inside of him? I would have said, no, he's a mid-card guy, love him on 3MB, not a main event guy, never will be. And in 10 minutes, he changed my mind. And I'm not knocking WWE because they were working with what they thought they had. But I think he's somebody in the same way that when I left WCW in both 90 and 94 and wanted to come back as a different guy to be taken more seriously. He's somebody I think the company needs to have an eye on because I was like, wait a second, I forgot this guy's 6'7". He's 270 pounds. He's ripped. He's a good, you forget he's a good looking kid.
Right.
And I'd never seen a dose, you know, like a thimble full of aggression in him. And it was like all there in Scotland. I mean, feeding off the crowd, announcers calling it like a match. It was really exciting. And it just did that idea that if you're not happy with your lot in life, you do something about it. And I think I just wanted to make it a point on your show because I know your show carries some weight. You know, this is like I wanted to write a post about it, but if you go over a couple hundred words on a post, people lose interest.
Right.
And so if you're out there, you know, people, check that out. You'd be shocked at how good that kid can be. 29 years old, he comes back in a year or two as a man instead of a kid and doesn't let people remember him the way he was. You've probably seen it. You've seen good wrestlers come into WWE. They just seem to almost physically shrivel. The ring's a little bigger. Everybody's 6'6", 270. And unless you got in your head that you absolutely positively belong there, you know, you shrivel up. Psychologically,
I'm talking to the legend Mick Foley. We're talking about all kinds of bullshit here today on the show. I'll take a pause for the calls and a word from my sponsors. Coming right back with the one and only Mick Foley.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Do you own a home or condo? Or perhaps you run a house or apartment? Sure you do. And Geico knows it can be hard work. Because whether you own or rent, you still have to fill it full of your stuff. Your furniture, the flat screen, and all the boxes of stuff that have been sitting there ever since you moved in, but haven't unpacked. It's hard to find the time, right? But you know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. That way, you'll rest easy knowing that your home and all your stuff is protected. Like the furniture, and that flat screen. Plus, getting a quote on homeowner's and renter's insurance is super easy through Geico. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. You know, like going through all those boxes of stuff. Visit geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
Steve Austin, Unleashed.
All right, coming back with Mick Foley. And we're talking about your show, and it's basically about a good time. Same thing with my podcast, man. My job here, I feel, is just to entertain people. I mean, and it's about nothing. It's almost like a Seinfeld show. It's a poor man's Seinfeld. And I have to say that with great respect to Jerry Seinfeld. I'm not trying to put my name and his in the same paragraph conversation, nothing. But so people want to hear us talk about wrestling. Let's talk about it. Your physicality throughout your career was off the charts, extremely high threshold for pain. All the bumps that you took, probably you're paying the price for them now.
Yeah, definitely.
How you feeling?
It's been a tough couple of years, honestly. It really has. You know, I didn't know, we didn't know nearly as much as we did about concussions, first of all. And I thought a concussion was something that knocked you out, had you throwing up, and so I guessed I'd had six. And then we come to find out that it's not just the major blows, it's those cumulative blows, including body blows. Who would have known?
Yeah.
Like, who would have ever guessed that a backdrop on the floor, say, can you imagine, a neurologist, orthopedic guy looking at a backdrop on a concrete floor in slow motion, what that does to your body? And you think about it. I mean, I remember wrestling you at house shows, backdropping you, number one guy in the business, and you're taking backdrops in the concrete at house shows because you were doing what you thought you had to do to, you know, to, right. to pop that crowd. In retrospect, you know, man, maybe, you know, maybe some of those decisions weren't that sound, especially post-2004, you know, like.
Is that when it started catching up to you?
Well, at 99, I remember Hunter actually saying to me, like, people say, hey, Mick Foley must be, like, falling apart. And Hunter was like, no, he's, you know, he's actually moving around pretty good. That was, like, 98.
Yeah.
And within about a year, I mean, it was, I was like a different human being. Everything hurt. Like, it caught up. Mother Nature and Father Time kicked my ass in a hurry.
Mother Nature, Father Time.
Ah, brother.
But you didn't have any major surgeries yet. Did you have anything replaced? Or
you know what? Here's the here's part of the problem. I went to a, you know, a top, well, the neurologist gave me the two of them, ixnay. You know, it's kind of, this is something I'm proud of. This is, I want it on my epitaph. When Dr. Cantu from the Boston Center for Traumatic Encephalopathy told me in no uncertain terms that I could never go in the ring again. I looked at one of the top neurologists right in the eye and I said, I can work an entire match around my left knee. Like, that's a great wrestler line, right?
Yeah.
Like I can work an entire match around my left knee. And he looked at me and said, Mr. Foley, when you were in my office 2 weeks earlier, you struck me as a bright young man. He said, I've been doing a little reading. He said, you got a lot going on. He goes, if you think you can find another neurologist to clear you, that's up to you. But I'm telling you, as a neurologist, you should never be in the ring again. And it was like an enormous weight was off my shoulders. It really was. You know?
How so?
Because
someone gives you a reason to walk away?
The ball was right. taken out of my court. It's right. almost like a boxing match where the guy throws in the white, you know, the white towel.
They did it for you.
Yeah. And I had that talk with Edge like 6 weeks later. You know, I was driving through, you know, the mountains of North Carolina. I was like, hey, Edge lives somewhere around here. Gave him a call, and he was like at total peace with that decision. Because he realized coming back means risking paralysis. It's not a matter of guts. You can't do it. And I think guys like us, you need that guy telling you, you can't do it because otherwise you will be sitting there. And I probably could have had a good match with Dean Ambrose.
Right.
10 minutes, you know, with all the bells and whistles. I mean, I was even going to call Undertaker and say, can I please, for one match, can I come up through the ring? You know, like,
right.
I had it all, had all, everything lined up, and I thought we had a heck of a match. So it was easier for me to have it, the ball taken out of my hands and kind of walk over to that bench and sit down.
When I was in Seattle, WrestleMania 19, man, I was drinking a little bit, living too fast. I've told the story too many times. I won't tell it again. And I went to the hospital that night, ambulance, heart was going crazy, drinking too many speed stacks and all that other bullshit. And they put 4 liters of fluid in. I was dehydrated. Didn't really give me the clearance to wrestle the next day.
Yeah.
But I was going to because it was WrestleMania 19, and I knew I had to hang them up. And so I had to, you know, go to work because that's what we do.
Yeah.
So I went to work. Man, I remember showing up down there, and, man, Jason, the guy who works at WWF, had the place lit up. It was a beautiful building, you know, there in that arena there. KD and all the gang was there. JR rode with me. I was in a real, someone even looked at me wrong or talked to me. I damn near want to start crying because it's my last match. Yeah, we were in a good chance to tell everybody because I needed to ride off in the sunset because my guy said, hey, dude, you need to get out of Dodge and you need to do it now. So, you know, went and did it. But I remember Rock hit me with 3 rock bottoms on that last one. I laid there at 1, 2, 3. And, man, the feeling, it was just like what you said. A weight was lifted off my back. Because I didn't have to go out there and put anything on the line anymore. And don't get me wrong, I would have kept doing it, but someone took the ball out of my hand. So I felt that relief.
Yeah.
And it was, Steve, it's okay to go now because the doctor said, hey, you need to get your ass out of here.
Yeah.
So I felt like that. I felt relieved. And now when I look back, I'm, 12, 13 years removed. And I think if I never would have had the neck issues, I probably could have made at least another good 5, 6. And that was a pretty physical bumper.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, not crazy bumps like you, but a snapback bumper. But now when constant. I look back, I think had I stayed in the business, because I feel pretty decent right now, but there's days I feel like shit. I think I would feel more like shit had I got that extra 5 or 6. So I'm probably cool. Well, I am cool because I got all the business out of my system.
Yeah.
With riding off to the sunset when I did.
I had the sunset exit in 2000, and I had the sunset exit in 2004, and I had it in 2006. It was just, I couldn't, you know, it was like, who knew the economy was going to fall apart? You know, like, wait a second. So not only is the money I saved, like, not going to, it's losing money, you know, like, and there was right. this sense that I'd just written a second novel, which the world did not exactly, you know, line up to buy. And I was like, I can make as much money for a comeback match with Carlito. Like, there was still a market
right.
for a Mick Foley match, you know, and like, even if it wasn't a main event match, it was still something there. And I kept going to that well. And, you know, man, if I could have, you know, taken an eraser and rewritten history, you know, anything post 2006 would have been off the record for sure.
So what about all this stuff with Christopher Nowinski, the Brain Institute, whatever it's called? I say that with respect. I just don't know what it's called.
Boston Center for Traumatic Encephalopathy.
Have you been there?
I just say that continuously because if I can continue to say it correctly, I know.
You still got it.
A couple times. I want to do next year's show. I want to deal with some of the head trauma. And I've dabbled in it a little bit where I've said, as long as I continue to say the words Boston Center for Traumatic Encephalopathy, I know I'm okay. And a couple minutes later, I'll come back to the Boston Center for Traumatic Encephalopathy, and I'll start coming up with different ways to screw up the name.
Right.
And it's an uncomfortable laughter because not everybody understands that right. I'm messing it up on purpose. And it's kind of like a clever thing where you're getting the laughs from a few people, but it's like, I don't know if I'm supposed to be laughing right. at this guy's expense.
Right.
And that's one of the things I'm looking for is like, if I do want to make a serious statement in my show, how do I do it? And I've talked to Brendan Burns, who's a brilliant comic from Australia and knows the wrestling business, has a real good feel for the wrestling business. If it wasn't for the fact that Vince would personally hate him and have him thrown out by the end of the first day, he'd been an outstanding asset to the writing team. And I asked him about that, and he's like, mate, you're going to get that series, you got to have a killer final 15. And I don't have a way to go from there, but
right.
it's like you drive down the road. It reminds me so much of like coming up with a match for a pay-per-view, you know, like you got your sections, you got your moves, especially for me, I had a limited set of moves and I had to keep thinking of different ways to combine them, throw them in, you know, different ways of making the matches exciting. And when it clicks, the same way that, you know, the match would come together and click and you'd have that vision in your head, it's the same feeling of fulfillment. I'm not there yet. I don't know how to do next year's show yet. I'm having fun.
So how's the gray matter inside your cranium? You good? You fucked up?
Well, you know, it's going to be a waiting game, you know? I mean, I'm donating.
I have little memory lapses here and there now. Sometimes I can't, you know, I always joke to my damn wife. I say, hell, man, sometimes, Kristen, the faster I cross the room, the sooner I forget why I crossed it. I have a fleeting moment like that, but I can't say that that's because I got hit with a bunch of steel chairs because I was a hands-up guy. Probably had, you know, 2 to 3 concussions due to activity in the ring, just to a bump gone wrong.
Yeah.
So I can't chalk it up myself up. And I got lit up playing football now here or there a few times.
When they asked me how many times you've seen stars, that's yeah. another. I was like, what? What do you mean? Like hundreds? You know, like yeah. you're telling me. And I
brother, remember, you don't see stars. You see constellations.
I always used to wrestle Undertaker, you know, and then I'd charge him in that corner. He'd bring up the boot, and I'd have the chair in my hands.
Yeah.
And the percentage of people who would have known the difference between real contact and some space would be so minimal. But to me, if I didn't feel those stars, I wasn't doing it right.
Right.
And going back in time, I would have had that hand, you know, what would it have hurt?
Right.
To put not only the hand up between my chair and, you know, in that boot, but to put that chair up when those chairs were traveling at high speed.
Mick, you went to wrestling school, and at the core, your beginning was with Dominic DiNucci, correct?
Right.
Now, in this school of professional wrestling, two questions. How long was the wrestling school, and did you learn how to take a chair shot?
I'll answer no.
Two questions.
All right, yeah. I'll answer the second one first.
Okay.
No. There was never like a chair shot
okay.
in class.
Okay, we'll skip the rest of the wrestling. Talk about a chair shot, because all of a sudden, there I was in Dallas, Texas, yeah. soon to go down to Tennessee, and I'm forced to use a steel chair, because as an angle ensues or progresses, you get in your first angle, inevitably a chair will come into your hands
yes.
or onto your head.
Yeah.
You've either got to take it or receive it. You've been trained to do either one.
No.
Neither one.
No.
So what was your experience with the steel chair?
You know, in Dallas, they had that one clunky steel chair. Like, you know, no one even thought, hey, why don't we go to a department store and buy steel chairs? You know, even when I remember wrestling, staying at Beach Blast, and part of the reason we did well is because I went and searched the arena and found a steel chair. You know, Sid had a match earlier on. They went to use a chair, and they had that horrible cushion chair with the hinges that looks awful.
Yeah.
It doesn't
Because it looks to the crowd like, first of all, those chairs are heavy. They hurt your vertebral structure.
Yeah.
But to the crowd, because they have a pad on them, that doesn't hurt all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So then you have to go to the core steel chair.
Exactly. And no, the one we had in Dallas was awkward, had rust all over it.
Piece of shit.
And one of the first times I took a chair, I broke my thumb, putting my hand up. And the lesson I took from that was my head was harder.
Than my thought,
you know, wrong lesson.
Yeah.
But also keep in mind that at that time, you know, you would work, you were working a gimmick, and you were working a character. And I had an act, and when I say he was on me, I mean in a good way. He would come to me and, Jack, you worked so hard. Yeah, he goes, but you're so nice to the fans. You know, like that was my weakness when you're in a territory every week, Friday, Saturday.
Yeah.
People get that feel. It's part of what I talk about during my current show. And I love talking about it. I love the current show. I try to figure out ways every night to make it better. But I talk about that almost like collective realization, you know, after a certain point, you know, where you'd see all the wild moves, and I had the eyes, which always put a question mark in people's minds. But it would be like about that 6 month mark. If you'd watched for 6 months steadily, and then I'd come down with that elbow, I'd look up at that camera. It was almost like you could feel people going, he's a nice guy. Like they would.
Oh, you got that?
I thought
she was crazy.
What?
I mean, that's a compliment.
And I was helped in WWE, the mask,
right,
which I only recently came to find out through Bruce Pritchard was really just Vince's way of hiring me while covering up my face.
Really?
It was not meant as a deep psychological ploy. It was just JR waging a steady campaign on my behalf, and finally Vince slamming his hand down at a meeting going, all right, damn it, I'll bring him in, but I'm covering up his face. Like, this is a quote.
Is that a shoot?
That would have stung a little bit had I known that.
Dude, when you cut off that beard and all the bullshit, you're a good-looking dude.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be
former Joe,
a dime, great friend. Here I am, straight as an arrow. You're a good-looking dude.
I was not a bad-looking guy, and I had to do a lot with smoke and mirrors. But that goes back to creating that image in the sportatorium. You would go up, you'd have Bill Covell, you know, and Big Mike.
Cowboy
Bill walking you up, that really protective rope that would keep you from the fans. It was like
rope. It was big around as this cord that goes to my Mac laptop computer. And that rope, the barrier said to the people, do not cross. You stay here, wrestlers over there. It was the most horseshit, unsafe environment in the history of the wrestling business. But it was great. It worked for the sportatorium.
It worked for the sportatorium. You look back at all the missed opportunities, nobody taking a guardrail. You couldn't shoot somebody into the rope. A little white clothesline.
Take me into the guard rope.
But I would walk up after Bill would lead me in. There'd be like that 20-foot walk from the aisle to the dressing room. And to the day it was torn down, there was a section that was almost completely dented, because when I would come back from my matches, you'd have 10 or 12 people looking at you. I would slam my head 5-6 times in there, because the idea was those 10 people would tell 10 other people. And
he really is crazy.
And sometimes, I mean, I knew where the beams were. At least I thought I would. I'd avoid the beams.
Yeah.
Usually I missed them.
Right.
Sometimes I wouldn't.
Right.
Looking back now in 97, when my back really seized up on me and I was really struggling, but needed to give people what I thought they deserved as far as a physical match was concerned.
Right.
Like I was, okay, I can't take the bumps that I'm known for. How do I create the illusion, you know, of wildness?
And this was in WWF.
This is
correct?
WWF.
Yeah.
I'm working
but
with,
let's go back to World Class Championship Wrestling, because you broke into the business in what year?
I broke in 85.
85. By the time you got down to World Class, I mean, well, you might have been there before, but I remember paying a ticket to see you wrestle.
Thank you.
There I was, and then I was in Chris Adams' school.
Yes.
And you saw me when
first
you were out there in the crow's nest.
This is another statement of where my head was at the time. I'd been gone from home for 7 or 8 months. I could have easily said, can I have 1 week off to go back home and see my family? really would not have been an issue. But in my head, there needed to be a reason why I wasn't at that TV. In retrospect, how many people would have cared? How many flags would have been raised? They said, why isn't Cactus Jack at TV? I thought I needed a reason, and the reason was I'm going to be stretchered out.
Right.
And for the $25 Friday, you know, Saturday morning payoff, I took the Nestea plunge off that ring apron, and you could actually see on
That's
the
That's what
thing,
I'm getting
yeah,
at. That spitting Nestea plunge.
Yeah, spitting up, coughing up gobs of blood, and then Akbar cuts the great promo, you know, where he goes, Mark Lauren says, look at Cactus Jack, never mind that. Look at this expensive shirt. And Ak told me later, you know, that's what he always did, was plant that seed,
right.
You know, like that he deep down didn't care about his guys. But instead of going home, you know, I got carried out. I wasn't going to let anybody see me walk out of that arena. I was going to wait until so many hours had elapsed that there would be nobody to see me leave. When I got powerbombed on the concrete by Vader in WCW, I left my car in the parking lot for 6 weeks. Because that was the type of thing that made a difference.
And they didn't tow to Summit Jeff?
At that, no, that was
back in the old days. You'd have been gone in 3 days, since 72 hours, 2 days. Hey, man, when you used to drop that elbow or the
well, let me just make but the point was, that's why I was in the crow's nest, because I didn't want anybody to see me leaving the sportatorium. And I just happened to be there on the day that class began. And you know the way a wrestling group, a school is. I mean, it's like, you know, you can kind of cast off just about almost all the guys almost immediately. And sometimes you're going to make a mistake, as people did with me. But it was like, oh, all right, that one kid's got that it thing going on. And obviously, you know, it turned out to be you.
Yeah, shit, I got lucky. But I remember I want to go back to you dropping that elbow off, because, I mean, you always drop it off on that one side, it seemed.
Yeah.
Because Crow's Nest was here. You don't like drop it right there. I'm sitting here drawing on my table here. And Mick's saying, yeah, so it's true. You just can't see it. It's audio, not video. I got to learn that. I'm going to get some cameras in here one of these days. Dude, what made you decide to take that leap of faith onto concrete way back in the day? And was it because that was who Cactus Jack was? Was he out of control, crazy, willing to inflict damage on a person however he could? Or were you looking at its core when you started doing that to be noticed by somebody to get a push?
Robert Fuller is one of the first guys that had faith in me. I think you had about as good a time in Memphis as I did. You know,
I learned a lot.
I learned a lot too. Yeah, I didn't like it. I've since made peace with Randy Hales. Randy brought me and my family to the circus. I realized a valuable learning experience. You go in, you don't know who your opponent is until you get, you know, you see your name on the chalkboard.
Right.
You walk out there, you haven't seen the guy, haven't talked to him, you're putting a match together. You're learning as you go. I learned a lot, but I wasn't treated particularly well there.
Gotcha.
And Robert was the guy who had faith in me. And Robert saw me take a... And I'm going to drop a second F-bomb on you.
Go ahead.
It is a noteworthy line.
This is unleashed.
Robert saw me take that Nestea plunge at a spot show for $25 payoff. And, man, that concrete just about knocked me out. And it opened up a nasty wound on the back of my head. And I went back in, and Robert goes, damn, Jack, looks like a pussy sitting on your head. I don't know whether to stitch it or fuck it. I don't do Robert Fuller justice.
Stop. I've never asked anybody for an instant replay in all my life. Repeat that punchline again. Mother, that is tremendous.
All right, in slow motion. That looks like a big old pussy on your head. Damn, Jack. I don't know whether to stitch it or fuck it.
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life.
But on the way home, he told me, listen, son, that's a mighty impressive bump. You know, I'll stop trying to do Robert's voice.
No,
it's a mighty impressive bump. He said, but you gotta take care of yourself. You have to do these things when they're meaningful. A couple weeks later, we're driving, and Robert's a lead heel in Memphis, and he's, you know, Robert had a great mind, and it just wasn't clicking that day. He's like, I don't know what to do. Oh, man, and you see, he didn't want to blow off the angle in the first week. You know, he was looking for a way to do a return match. And I said, Rob, I have an idea.
What was the program?
This is Jeff Jarrett had just gotten Robert's loaded boot.
Okay.
You know, so he had the loaded boot, and we knew there was going to be trouble.
To any of my Steve Austin show listeners out there that don't know what a loaded boot is, Mick, what is it? Because people are there, what the fuck's a loaded boot?
He actually had some kind of apparatus sewn into the sole of the boot, and he would kick, you know, he would kick it, and it would jingle, and then he would use it, and there'd be bloodshed.
And, for example, like when Cornette had the tennis racket, sometimes they would load that thing up, and they'd put a horseshoe in the zippered covers. That's loading, and that's putting a foreign object or a piece of steel, allegedly, or sometimes for a shoot, in an object. So Robert Fuller,
loaded the boot. Jeff Jarrett had gotten a hold of the loaded boot. We knew there was going to be trouble. But in Memphis, you have to come back four or five times. You're there every week. You have to think of a way to come back next Monday. And Robert was looking for a way to the next Monday without blowing off the program in the first week. And I was riding with Robert. If it had been anybody else in the territory, and I said, I've got an idea, I probably would have been just ignored or shunned. Right. And he goes, well, damn, Jack, let me hear it. And I said, well, I think this might be the time for that Nesty plunge. And as it turned out, I didn't know at the time that, you know, the wrestling fans had their annual convention and, you know, the Observer was there. And, you know, I ended up taking that Nesty plunge in front of, like, the hardcore, you know, Observer fans.
Right.
And I guess it left a pretty lasting memory. And there was a, you know, there was blood. I mean, it was a pretty wild scene, but it was the right bump for that show. And then every time, especially when I turned babyface, we were looking for ways to create that type of impact. From a selfish point of view, though, I realized, wait a second, I need to have something offensive. Like, this can't be my calling card, is that everything I do.
You're sacrificing your body.
Yeah, yeah. Like, how
you're
do
beating
I,
you up,
right.
not him.
How do I take that willingness and ability to absorb punishment and make it work for me offensively? And I wanted to be the guy. I mean, I was a Superfly fan. You know, I mean, I used to, you know, one of my firmest memories in college is I was looking out at this house. I was at a party, a sophomore in college, right before a couple months before I ended up meeting DiNucci. And I was like, just looking at the house next door, a guy comes over to me, a good friend of mine. He goes, what are you looking at? I said, you think if I dove off the top of that roof, would that garbage can break my fall? Like, I always wanted, I needed to know there was something. That was big. Like, would that break my fall? All right, if I dive off of this sand dune with the waves coming out with those 3 inches, would that break my fall?
Right.
I wanted to be a Superfly guy. I couldn't because I couldn't balance on the top rope. And you couldn't do anything as good as Jimmy did. I'm a firm believer, why be the second best at something? I was just talking today on the hip-hop station at Sirius about the
hey, you're a big hip-hop guy.
It was a perfect fit. not likely to draw a single fan to one of my shows. But I was asked about the evolution. Just hear me out here for a second. Yeah. The evolution of mankind and the fact that it was actually the Cell match that made me see, wait, I got to find a different way to connect with people. And you may not want to take credit for this, but when your character just skyrocketed, there were like six or seven like Steve Austin lights, you know, like guys saying, I'm going to, and everyone, people, whether they knew it or not, were trying to be like you and not being successful at it. And I was a big believer. I'm not going to be the seventh best Stone Cold. There's an open market there for like the nerd fans, you know, and I need to find a way to make some people laugh to make that connection. So I went in that direction. But going back to the elbow, that was my way of finding, taking the talent that I did have for taking some wild chances and making it work for me as an offensive move.
But a question, and before I ask you the question, when I'm talking about loaded objects, you know, one of my favorites, Mid-South Wrestling, Bill Watts, the loaded Gucci bag. Missy Hyatt would wop Dark Journey with that loaded Gucci bag. I mean, that was one of the damnedest loaded gimmicks of all time, Missy Hyatt's loaded Gucci bag. If you hadn't seen it, go back and Google Mid-South on YouTube. I'm talking to the legend Mick Foley, we're talking about all kinds of bullshit here today on the show. I'll take a pause for the calls and a word from my sponsors. Coming right back with the one and only Mick Foley. All right, coming back with Mick Foley. My question to you is, Mick, when you did that, what do you call it? The fallback?
Nesty plunge.
Okay.
Yeah.
My question for you, Mick, is when you took the Nesty plunge to help preserve that angle so that you didn't have to blow it off that night, and so that it was so, satisfactory, a feeling of accomplishment.
Yeah.
Did you become addicted to that and say, hey, I got to do this more? Because I know you're just talking about moving to the future. You need to use it on the offensive front. But did you become almost a thrill seeker or a pain seeker in wanting to
actually
take the bumps you did?
I was pretty realistic. I mean, I didn't know the long-term ramifications. Right. I didn't know, for example.
Let me ask you this first. How far down the road were you looking in your career? Because I didn't look down the road, man. I was living for the here and the now and waking up the next morning.
Steve, even in Dallas, I gave myself till I was 26. I'd like to think I would have had the strength of character to admit that gig was up. If I was 26, I wasn't making a decent living. Livable apartments, car. Not,
were you
not
married
rich.
In Dallas?
No, I wasn't. Okay. I wasn't married. And I would go down to the TV studio in Las Colinas twice a week, and I would watch video Bob Von Gursky put the show together. And it's funny, if people go back and watch the old World Class show, I would do several of the voiceovers. I produced a couple of the videos.
Really?
I was pretty hands-on. There was even a time when Bob wanted to take a vacation. They were going to put me in charge of directing the show because I had the background in college. I was always fascinated. I was considered a pain in the neck by some people, because I was walking around saying, can you get this camera shot coming from a low, the camera, here's the elbow, and I realize this is my bread and butter. And at that time, it was the 13 to 14 foot, length, back when I had a little spring in my legs. Yeah. And even then, there was very little, but I realized.
But you were already looking to the people with the camera to help you look more like a superstar.
So if people go home and they watch that Nesty Plunge with Mil Máscaras, it's a hell of a bump, but Jackie Crockett had the perfect camera shot, and as I hit, he shook that camera.
Right.
And like I said, when I got to WWE, there was just a little bit of feeling, when I would walk through, hey, this is what I'm trying to do, this is what I'm trying to accomplish. And now the producers are up there. What are you trying to do? What are you trying to accomplish? How can we do this? And, I hadn't seen my match with the Big Show in the Boiler Room in years. My son Huey is such a fan. I don't, as a habit, go back and watch my old things.
Me neither.
But I remember Kevin remarking, he liked the way, the knock on me, from people who were not Mick Foley guys, for lack of a better word, they're just a big bump guy. But I always wanted there to be a story, and I remember Kevin Dunn really heaping praise on me, after that match, when I was clearly way past my physical prime and I was just about to go out for some fairly extensive knee surgery. We told a heck of a story, complete with, as I made it to that wall, I made sure, with the palm all bloody, that I had that palm print and smear, he was going to leave an impression. So I was real big believer in thinking visually way back, I think before most people, before it entered most people's minds.
You brought up a name there, Mil Máscaras. There's a story there. Were you a Mil Máscaras fan?
I did not enjoy working with Mil. And I know, Alberto's his nephew. I recognize he's a legend who drew money everywhere that he went. But he wasn't, he wasn't interested in doing business that night. And, I tried to remember the way.
So what was the story? This was was it a pay-per-view?
It was a Clash of the Champions.
And so you're going to work with Mil Máscaras.
I'm going to work with Mil.
So what's his beef with you?
No beef, but WCW, which sometimes we're not big picture thinkers.
Correct.
We were in Corpus Christi. And the small picture is, let's get a pop from the Latino audience. Bigger picture is, here's a full-time guy. Why are we having, he's got some promise. He's a guy we want to use. Why are we having him lose on national TV in the Clash to a guy who won't be here ever again? And I was set to, Mil was late, missed his flight, set to wrestle Rick Fargo, actually pick up a victory on Clash of the Champions. And then, Mil came in, I'd say 20, 25 minutes before the match. And it was just a series of arm drags, I managed to get that last, that one move. And I just wanted to kick out, and I caught flack, from the powers that be, you were not kicking out under, and I wanted that image, and I didn't get it. But what I did have was Jim Ross and Jim Cornette making me look like the superstar that Mil didn't,
right.
I mean, as great as JR's, good God is my witness, broken in half, not far behind it, and much less heralded was Cactus Jack is dead. You know, Jimmy had that high voice.
Yeah.
Wasn't a perfect TV voice, but you go back, he was quick.
Yeah.
He knew his wrestling. He got people over. And I liked people who put the product before themselves, even if they had a larger than life personality. And there were a lot of guys who spring to mind. Cornette was one of them. Michael Hayes, I thought, was very unheralded as an announcer, as was Kevin Sullivan, who, even though these guys were gimmick guys,
right,
would go out of their way to put the guys in the ring over, which I try to keep in mind when I had my short stint behind the microphone.
So where did the Cactus Jack gimmick come from?
Cactus Jack was
Who was he?
He was Cactus Jack was my generic gimmick that I was only going to do long enough to become Dude Love.
Dude, you was born in Indiana. You grew up on Long Island. How in the hell did you come up with Cactus Jack? Because that ain't Long Island.
Listen, my dad, and I wrote about this in my book, but I love and miss my dad, and I'll take this opportunity to talk about him. My dad had a reputation in our school system as a disciplinarian. You know, the fact that he had a kid who, you know, sometimes did things a little differently, you know, was a cause of some concern, you know, like, because my dad was like such, you know, the crew cut, you know, there's no pictures in the Foley family vault of my dad with bell bottoms and pork chop sideburns. You know, he was the crew cut guy. He was the athletic director. And in the book, I talked about how Ward Melville High School was the only high school that didn't allow any like taunting or stomping when opponents were taking foul shots, because they would try to do that. And my dad would just look up at that crowd with, you know, we had this one glance and poof, you'd see like 800 people stand down. And Cactus Jack was just a game, that name that I came up with for my dad when we were playing, like, it wasn't an internet wrestling game. It was the magazine wrestling game. You could send away, you know, you cut something out from the Bill Apter magazine, and then like 3 months later, you got this little board game. And there would be characters that you knew were supposed to emulate WWF guys, you know, the characters that were supposed to, the Dusty Rhodes character, a very similar name. And then there were some spaces you could fill in your own names. And I was Big Train Foley. That's who I thought I was going to be. And my Big dad Train was Foley. Cactus Jack.
Yeah.
And so later on, you know, as months passed, and I created this Dude Love persona for myself, which really was a wig, an orange headband, and a pajama top that somehow made me feel cool. I would put it on, I would go out at night, and I would have confidence that I did not have without it. It sounds absolutely ridiculous. But I was smoother, I could talk with women in a way I never could as Mickey Foley.
Mickey Foley.
Mickey.
So when were you doing the Dude Love?
I was doing it I did it, you know, in a home movie that involved the, you know, the first.
So you were Dude Love some 10, 20 years
before
you
turned into
Dude Love.
I was Dude Love in 80, yeah, I was Dude Love in 85 and 86. And then the deal was, you know, I became Cactus Jack. I was Dude Love in 83 and 84. Started wrestling in 85 with the intention of becoming Dude Love when I got good enough to earn that name.
Right.
And then along the way, I realized, you know, Mother Nature is not cooperating. I'm not Dude Love. I am this guy. You know, it's Cactus Jack on the surface seemed to be like a Western motif, and we kind of turned it into something completely original. You know, with a very generic sounding name, created a very original concept.
Where did Bang Bang come from?
Bang Bang, man, I love this story. It was just like some of the craziest things, just come out of thin air. It was. If I say you're gonna pop, and we're not gonna, people won't see you smile. But if I say the name Nasty Ned Brady, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. He was an I never call him job guys. He was an enhancement guy who had the greatest facial features. You know, the greatest facial expressions, kind of like buggy whip arms. You know, he was like me without the love handles. You know, he was like a thinner version from a muscularity standpoint. He's like me without the added body weight. And he sold things magnificently. And at the third or fourth week, I guess, you know, it was November of 89. I'd been turning on my partners for three, four, 5 weeks. It was starting to catch on. Like, people were actually looking forward to these tag team contests that I would lose or my partner would lose. And I would then turn on that partner with the elbow, you know, and then put him out 12, 13 feet. Boom, here we go. And I dropped that elbow, and it was a good one on Nasty Ned Brady. And as I lay there, as I sat up, the song Love Shack, B-52s came into my head. and you can see it on the For All Mankind DVD, I actually say, bang, bang, bang on the door, baby. I actually sing the lyrics. And that was the last time I sang the lyrics, but I kept bang, bang. It was also, I believe, either that night or the next night, the last match I wrestled with front teeth. I was in a, you know, went home, was at a friend's bachelor party, and we got hit head on by a drunk driver, and those teeth were history, you know. And, you know, against my better judgment, you know, I had well wishers come to the hospital and say, hey, this is good for wrestling. And I'd be, no, that image of the guy with the missing teeth that's long gone, and this is not good. And then when I showed up, I remember Jim Ross going, great look. and you got to take what you can.
Yeah.
You know? Like you got to take what you can. And so I thought, oh, this is a pretty good look. So much so, you know, I've never really gone and replaced them.
So what was your favorite part of you to be? Mick Foley, Dude Love, Mankind, Cactus Jack. Did I get them all?
I love, you know what, Steve?
What's the difference between all of them?
We collectively, you know, and I'm talking about WWE, I'm talking about Vince, specifically in one case, Hunter, did a great job of creating the differentiation in people's minds. You know, to some people, they say, I forget about the cell match. My favorite moment is when you did the promo where you transformed from Mankind to Cactus Jack, keeping in mind that all I was doing was removing one shirt to reveal another. And the character wouldn't have been dead, but greatly reduced Ted Hunter just laughed and given that you're the same guy with a different shirt.
Right.
And he didn't go that route. He put it over like he was seeing a ghost, you know, like a larger-than-life superhero. I'm getting goosebumps talking about it, you know. And it was one of those, you know, great moments, like a do-or-die moment. This guy either means something or he doesn't. And fortunately, you know.
But he saw that.
Yeah, he saw it. It meant something. And quite honestly, you know, you go back, and if you're looking for that mythical Cactus Jack, like, he's there in spots, you know. Like, you know, there are certain matches where I was as good as, you know, Hunter was making me out to be, but I think WWE did a very good job of creating this mythical character from a guy who was a very good performer, but not mythical by any means.
So then, which one of those guys was your favorite to be? Which one of those guys was your favorite to work? Or which one of those guys was easiest to work?
The closest to my heart was the commissioner in 2000.
Yeah.
You know, where I completely changed courses. And I said, you know, I went home. I did believe I was retired, and I went to Hershey Park, and I traded out a 20-minute Q&A in the park for, like, the run of the place for 4 days, meals included. So I made out pretty well in that deal, and I had one of those little, you know, shaving kits, the head shaver. I went home, and I went back to the room, shaved off all my hair, which had been a trademark. It had been long since 85. And my son, Dewey, was there. He thought it looked cool. So, I shaved his head, too. We got some great photos of us going down the log flume with no hair. And that was my signal to myself. I would never do anything in the public eye ever, like ever again. That was dead set, never. And it was 2 days later, I get a phone call. I get home, and I get a phone call. Hey, pal, how'd you like to be the commissioner? And I was like, all right, you know, and I showed up, and you know, and somebody
that hey pal was the famous Vince McMahon phone call voice, which is either the best phone call you could ever take or a bunch of hassle.
And it was that same hey pal. It was like at 7 a.m.
He's so charismatic and he's good on the phone.
Hey pal, but 7 a.m. like the hey, guy pal. Never sleeps.
Yeah, he went, got an idea man. For you.
How'd you like to be Dude Love? And I went, like, once?
He said that to you?
He said that to me on the phone.
They came up with Dude Love?
No. What it was and this, I remember this.
You already been Dude Love.
This is, you said this to me, and this is one of the things I talk about during the current show, because I love the idea that I can take people back and go into Mankind and give them that feeling of being that 97 Mankind by taking them back to the interview segment.
Right.
Right? Dustin Rhodes had just done what was at the time really groundbreaking interview where he said, I'm Dustin Runnels. I'm the son of a famous wrestler. Talking about living, you know, in his dad's shadow.
Yes.
He referred to it as his character. Or I don't think he's his gimmick, but his character. And WWE wanted to do the same thing with me as Mankind, because Vince had come to realize that I had a more interesting real-life story than the fictional one we created as Mankind. And it was one of those things, again, where you have to have a feel for your character. You got to fight what you think is right. And they wanted me to go out and talk to the fans just as I'm talking to you and say, my name is Mick Foley. I used to be Cactus Jack. I've been wearing this mask. And I said, man, I got a lot of time and effort tied up in this character. And I propose that we go out unscripted. Jim Ross pulled it off. Probably nobody else could have. And for years, I considered it to be one of the top two or three things I'd ever done in the business. I said, what if JR asks me questions? I will answer them with 100% honesty, but I'll do it in character. And you probably heard this as well. I remember Al Snow telling me the first day I was in WWE that you couldn't really become a top guy until Vince personally became a fan. And up until that night in 97, that wasn't the case. Like, I was used good, you know, I'd been on top of a couple pay-per-views. I think if you'd ask Vince deep down, are you a fan of this guy, he would have been on the border. And JR and I just went in, and again, you know, you know, to me, the intangibles, like that magic in the air, is can't be scripted. It's gotta be an element there, and I think we lose some of that. I think with the scripting, you lose a lot of the lows, you eliminate a lot of the horrible interviews, but you also lose that element, you know, the possibility of magic. And if they'd scripted that, it may have worked. It wouldn't have worked on a level that it did, because it was like, I remember you and I riding, and by that time you were kind of a loner by 97, you know? So it was unusual that we'd be riding again like the old days. And I remember you saying, what are they doing, kid? They turn you baby face? And I said, no, Steve, I think they just want people to get a better feel for the character. You looked at me and said, you'll be a baby face in 3 weeks. And to the best of my knowledge, it's the only time that I can recall a turn taking place without any in-ring change, without any, you know, saving of a hero. It was just that every week they would unroll this thing. And when I told the story, I didn't even know Vince was in the room. It was all dark. And they said, all right, we're going to change tapes. And I heard a voice in the darkness go, this is outstanding. And I was like, that's it. Like, I'm a made man in WWE. Like, that was the most pivotal moment, I think, of my career, when I became a star in WWE.
Right.
Yeah.
God dang, that's
good. It's going pretty well, right? I was a little nervous we weren't going to live up to the billing. We're doing pretty good.
No, we are living up to it. But what I want to do, I'm going to run to the refrigerator. I'm going to grab an ice cold beer, and I want to continue the conversation. But this will be for next Thursday. I want to talk about ECW. I want to talk about your thoughts on promos. I mean, the stuff you were cutting in ECW was just pure gold. And, man, I was there just watching it. I mean, all through your career. I mean, multi-layered, complex shit. I mean, it was crazy. And so I enjoyed watching all that and listening to it. So, but before we leave, we know you're on the road.
I'll be in Thursday night. I'm in Brea. Friday and Saturday I'm in Ventura, and then I take a little time off to go to professional Santa Claus school in Denver, and then I pay for that trip by doing a show in Denver on July, because I'm still old school that way. August 31st, and then, as you mentioned, I got like a 3-week run in British Columbia and Alberta, Canada.
We're gonna pick some of those up on the next show we're fixing to do on Twitter. He is real Mick Foley, because there's some fake Mick Foleys out there. He's the real one on Twitter, real Mick Foley. His website, you can catch all his dates for his one-man show, realmickfoley.com. All kinds of cool shit coming from Mick Foley. Anyway, shutting her down. Mick, appreciate it. We're coming right back for the next week's show.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
All month long, the biggest movies are streaming free on Pluto TV's Popcorn Summer Movies. Watch star-studded blockbusters like Titanic and Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. Or fall in love with charming rom-coms like Hitch and How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. The best part? Pluto TV is 100% free. No credit cards, not even a sign-up. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies, TV shows, and more. Download the Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free.
Do you own a home or condo? Or perhaps you run a house or apartment? Sure you do. And Geico knows it can be hard work. Because whether you own or rent, you still have to fill it full of your stuff. Your furniture. The flat screen. and all the boxes of stuff that have been sitting there ever since you moved in, but haven't unpacked. It's hard to find the time, right? But you know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. That way, you'll rest easy knowing that your home and all your stuff is protected, like the furniture and that flat screen. Plus, getting a quote on homeowner's and renter's insurance is super easy through GEICO. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. You know, like going through all those boxes of stuff. Visit GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com.
Hey, this is Adam Carolla. Let me tell you about my podcast. We do it every single day, so you can subscribe, and there'll always be a fresh one waiting for you. It's about 2 hours of topical topics and news and guests and comedians and, of course, my own vitriolic take on just about everything that's going on in the world. Plus, we get a lot of really interesting, notable people who come in. We'll get politicians. We'll get tastemakers. We'll get stand-ups. We'll get authors. We'll get pundits. We'll get, I think about covers it all, celebrities as well. And we'll do some really interesting interviews with them. You can get The Adam Carolla Show wherever you download your podcasts.